This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. This week's episode was recorded on March 27th, 2016. This week, Tia and Nick joined me, Mike Rappin, to talk about edgy comic books. It's a doozy and full of a few soapboxes, so get yourself ready for some thoughts on what actually constitutes edgy and why that can be both a good and a bad thing. And now, this week's episode. This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I am your host, Mike Rappin, editor-in-chief for Destroy the Cyborg. With me this week are two fantastic human beings, as always, Nick White.
Hey.
And Tia Vasiliou.
Hi.
Thank you both for joining me this week. I'm so excited that you're here and all that jazz, as I am every time the both of you are on, and quite honestly, every time we record this show. So maybe it goes without saying, but I'm going to say it anyways. How are the both of you doing, and how have comic books been for you?
Not too bad. I mean, Rebirth aside, not too bad.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, Rebirth. Yeah. Nick, how are you?
Oh, sorry. I didn't know if Tia was done, and I was also trying to quell my inner thoughts on Rebirth. So I'll try to rather briefly sum those up here.
Okay, go for it.
I'm really mad. I'm really, really mad. You can say, Nick, I didn't think there was any way you were going to be happy with this regardless, and you're probably true or right on that. The teams just don't look that impressive. The artwork, I don't know. And then, of course, you got the fact that a lot of these books are going to be, you know, double shipped per month. When you look at a lot of the pairings of the artwork on those books, I really, really like one of the guys, and then I really, really don't like the other guy. So then you have to sort of decide what you're going to do with that. For example, with Batman, you're going to get David Finch, which is like hardcore. This is what traditional comic book fans want. And then you're also getting, on the other week, you're getting Michael Janin, who was the Grayson artist and the Justice League Dark artist. And I love his stuff. Is that going to be enough for me to read Batman? I don't know. I think the double shipping thing and the rotating artist thing, and some books even have a third rotating artist, there's going to be a lot of soul-searching when that DC solicits catalog comes out, because yep. There's going to be a lot of money that's going to have to be thrown on the table. It's not just about being willing to try things and take a risk. There's going to be a lot of money involved in being willing to take that risk, so it might just not be worth it.
It seems like they are really doubling down on all the stuff everybody hates about comics. So
I think what you mean is the stuff that we hate about comics. They're doubling down on a lot of the stuff that the old guard is going to love.
Okay, but you know what? Here's the thing about that. Sorry, old guard, you're not enough anymore. Like, I think that comics, they can't rely on you guys. So good luck with that, DC.
Yeah, I mean, I will say to that point, maybe not that they're not enough anymore, but I think that DC and Marvel, anything, pretty much every publisher at this point, has to keep trying to get new readers, and I don't think that this type of format gets new readers. People don't want to say, oh, I have to invest $8 a month to keep up with this book. I don't want to do that. That's a lot for just Batman
or
just
Wonder Woman or Justice League. No new reader's going to do that.
Well, it'll exactly, be six exactly. Now that they're, what is it, drawing the line at $2.99 again. Whether or not they can keep it is another story.
Yeah, you're correct.
This sounds all bad. All bad. Parrot, who is running DC by choosing ping pong balls out of a bucket, you're making bad decisions.
It's, I don't want Batman as an abbreviated $2.99 book. I'm sorry. Like, I think the extra pages helped. I think being able to have a B story in the back if they wanted to tell one, which is what James Tynion frequently did when Scott Snyder was writing it, I think that was awesome. You know, put that down on the podcast, everyone. Nick White advocated for a more expensive Batman title. He's the devil. Yeah. But
well, quality over quantity, I think.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
It definitely is a risk, but people at the end of the day, I think they want quality media to read, and so if you ask them to spend a little bit more for something that is higher quality, I think that that's an easier ask than asking people to, especially new readers, to just be like, you know, constantly struggling to keep up with this endless stream of what sounds like is going to be kind of phoned in stuff
potentially.
And I think the problem is that if you look at Batman Eternal and if you look at Future's End, and obviously I don't have those figures in front of me right now, but offhand, I think both of those did rather well, critically, possibly not, but in terms of sales, both of them did really well. And so I'm sure DC is looking at those numbers and saying, well, if these people were willing to buy a book every week, then we can definitely get those people to scale that down to 2 books a month. And like I said, they're just trying to appeal to the old guard and whatnot, whatever. I forget who it was. It was probably Jim Lee or it was Jeff Johns who said, we all know that the only good Green Arrow stories involve him having a goatee. And I just about freaking lost it. I was like, how dare you demean Jeff Lemire? You know, he left, but that doesn't mean he's not going to hear this.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess time will tell, but DC's current strategy is just trying to bleed the old guard dry as much as they can, like siphon as much money out of them as is possible. Really, that's it.
Well, Mike, so I guess a more accurate answer to your question earlier is that we are not well and everything is on fire.
Really, 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 really right. Mad.
Right. Well, okay. DC Rebirth aside then, let's move on and get away from this badness and move into something good, something that we're excited about this week. Actually, no. What did you guys actually read this past week that you enjoyed? Outside of the Rebirth news, I mean, you had to have read something that was good, right?
Yeah, I had a good week in terms of stuff to read.
What'd you check out?
Well, I am continuing to read Angela, Queen of Hell. Number 6 was out last week. That's the Marguerite Bennett. And Stephanie Hans wasn't actually working on this one, but the art, Kimi Sinto, was still pretty great. I am liking this book because I love Angela and Sarah, and also they've introduced Leah of Hell and Thori, and these are just like my precious babies. I will follow them anywhere. I am getting a little impatient with the fourth wall breaking and all of the pop culture references, which generally I like, but at a certain point it feels like they are the entire substance of the story, which is frustrating when the story itself has a lot of potential. Like Angela and Sarah,
that's kind of a bummer.
Yeah, they have such an epic love story, and I want to hear more about that, and I want to hear more about like how they're, you know, they've decided to adopt Leah, and what is she going to do now living in New York? And there's just, I get it. I get that it's funny to make references to Hamilton, but it doesn't need to be in every scene.
Gotcha.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because I had just recently sent a thread to Mike from our comic books about someone who was quite happy that this book was ending / being canceled, whichever one, I don't know which one it is. And of course it was for the unsurprising reasons of they thought it was too, oh god, their favorite term, SJW, blah, yeah, blah 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 blah, yeah, blah, well, blah 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 blah, don't need to fill in the rest of those because you know what all of those comments are going to be. And
it's interesting that just by existing, a lesbian or trans woman is automatically a stand-in for social justice warriors.
Right.
Yeah, you know, the thing about that is Nick sent me that, and I there was no justification. They just were like, I hate this book. It's stupid. It's like, okay, yeah, that was enough for you to go out and start, you know, using slanderous words and cursing other people out and, like, getting real personal with your comments about things? Like, I don't know. It was a shit show, essentially. Like, it was the most ridiculous thread. And I've seen a lot of, like dislike for other books or other creators, but like that one was way out of line for no apparent reason. The person who submitted the thread was all over the place with their insults. It was really dumb.
They like, definitely lean into the relationship between Angela and Sarah. It is not played for titillation. It's definitely a really genuine love story between the two of them. So I can see how people who are used to lesbian romance being presented as
male, like, gaze.
Yeah, oriented. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I can see how this would be confusing for them.
Yeah. I think this is a very, very, very small minority of people, but just a very vocal, very like minority. But I'm glad that you're enjoying the book. I mean, I saw that it was ending, and I was kind of bummed, if only because I looked at the numbers on that, and or the CBR article that was linked in the thread actually said that this book was outperforming some other books that are sticking around. So it's kind of a bummer that it's getting canceled. So yeah, I don't know.
And I almost wonder if the, you know, pop culture references and the like just sort of ridiculously exaggerated fourth wall breaking is, I almost feel like that is a kind of middle finger to these complainers and to the powers that be that are ending the book right now. Because, you know, if they have only two books left, why not just throw everything at the wall, you know?
Right. I'm sure that last issue is going to be a doozy.
Right. I can get behind that. You know, I mean, so they just introduced Thor into the mix now. Like, I need to see some, like, Thor and Angela and hanging out with Leah. And like, there's just so much cool stuff that could happen with all of these characters hanging out together. And, mm-hmm. you know, maybe something good will come out of the ashes, like a phoenix rising from...
Hopefully not a dark phoenix.
Hopefully not a dark phoenix. Oh, no.
My limited Marvel. Mark's like, well, actually, dark phoenix is technically impossible. I brought this up in my... No.
I used to teach... when I was an academic, and I had a student write a paper about, like, a Freudian analysis of dark phoenix. It was very fascinating.
All about Chris Claremont's obsession with the character and how he can't let her go for some reason.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
There was a lot of references to, like, phallic obsession and lack of... Yeah. Anyway.
Mikey, yeah. Anyway.
What else did you read this week, Tia?
I also read Patsy Walker number 4. I went ahead and decided to forgive Kate Leth for writing... Issue 3, all about bed bugs. My skin is still crawling from that. Yeah.
No, thank you.
You gotta give me a warning there, please, so that I could just skip over those. That was because I think that's probably like something that terrifies me to the very marrow of my soul.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Yeah. I went and had my sheets washed on my bed, and then I like was going to sleep that night, and I realized. I don't know where these washers have been. I don't know what's been in this washer. And then just every part of me started itching.
It's awful.
With worry.
It's awful. So anyway.
New York City is terrifying.
New York City is horrible. As Patsy is discovering in this book.
Nice.
Obviously.
Okay.
But, okay, so it's a really cute story. She's trying to get this, like, temp agency for super-powered people off the ground because, like, they have bills to pay and stuff, you know? And it's rough. And they're all kind of fucking up at their sucky retail jobs, so including Patsy. And then this villainess who... I cannot for the life of me remember her name. She's like this obscure villainess from way back in the day who's banished from Asgard. She's basically like, you know, those scary non-licensed, like, Elmo-ish characters that hang out in Times Square.
Yeah, everyone I think knows.
Yeah.
Featured
yeah.
prominently in yeah. Kimmy Schmidt, yes.
She's... She's so this villainess is kind of like that version of Enchantress, and everyone's constantly kind of making fun of her for being the like non-licensed Enchantress, and she has like a chip on her shoulder about it. And it's really funny, and so Patsy is like going to go head to head with her, and I'm really loving the sort of light, quippy aesthetic of this book. I normally don't tend to like those kind of more all ages books, but this one is really fun so far. I'm enjoying it. The artwork is just so charming. I cannot mm-hmm. get over it. I love it. Like when Patsy turns into Hellcat, she does so in this like magical girl shower of little cat head silhouette. It's really cute. I like it a lot. Brittany Williams is the artist on this one. So yes. And then finally, my very favorite thing from last week, Mirror number 2. This is the Emma Rios and Hui Lim book that was originally going to be part of the 8 House series, and then Image, I don't know how they decided to make it its own thing. And it continues to be absolutely gorgeous. It's sort of watercolory, kind of... very painterly, and the story now has kind of gone back in time, so it's explaining a little bit of the backstory about like how Senna, the invisible hybrid dog girl, and Ivan the Mage got separated, and Senna gets more involved in the rebellion, and so she makes a few attempts to like infiltrate this stronghold, and then it skips back to the sort of present day that was established in the first issue, and mm-hmm. where the little mouse lab rat and the cat have gone off to look for her. But so it kind of explains how she got separated in the first place. And I love this book so much. It's beautiful. Get it and spend hours looking at it and thank me later.
All right. Cool. Nick, so what did you read this week?
Definitely a week for more trades than singles, but I managed to read volume 2 of Drifter from Image Comics. That's Ivan Brandon writing, and I believe Nick Klein on art. And I know you said it didn't immediately grab you, and I have to agree that the writing in this book is definitely the weaker element of the two. Nick Klein's artwork is just unbelievable, and it's so weird that I've never heard of him before this point. Just fantastic sort of painting style. But what really, really drew me to that book is Tom Mueller's graphic art or sort of design elements within the book. Some of the intertitled pages and some of the weird graphic design stuff he does with the back of the book, where like the UPC code is like the huge oversized, you know, list of, you know, line of numbers instead of the actual barcode, and all sorts of zany weird stuff like that that he does with it. And I think design is going to be one of those elements that within the next couple of years, much like colorists was 2 or 3 years ago, we're really going to see them come to the forefront and really appreciate what they do.
That would be cool.
In this case, it's Tom Mueller. And if you're wondering if you've seen his work before, he did Zero. If you've ever looked at Zero before, the design work on that book.
Yeah.
Or Divinity. Or Snowfall. Most recently, he did all of the little logos and whatnot for Snowfall. And it just really adds to the atmosphere of the book and just sort of makes a cover-to-cover immersive experience that isn't ruined by, you know, DC or Marvel putting a big ad on the back page or something like that. So
yeah,
we're never going to get this sort of treatment with something that's big too, but it's still nice to see. Beyond that, I read all the Future's End Volume 1, believe it or not, all 18 issues. I finally got around to it.
Yowza.
It's not the best thing I've ever read, and I own all three volumes now.
That's so diplomatic.
Right. I own all three volumes now because a while ago, Barnes had a big sale, and without finishing volume 1, I bought book 2 because I'm a moron, except I'm an even bigger moron because I stupidly actually bought book 3. No, this wasn't Nick White online accidentally clicking on the wrong box right next to the other box. No, this is me at a bookstore with a physical book, and I still bought the wrong one.
Numbers are hard.
Numbers are really hard, because then I had to be like, well, I own 1 and 3. How am I not going to buy 2?
Right.
But it's kind of like dumb and fun, and I guess there's always a place for that. And the only thing that's absolutely infuriating about this book is that with Batman Eternal, even though there were like 4 or 5 different writers working on the book, with each individual issue, they at least were like, okay, so they all worked on the story, but let's be honest, this issue was actually written by so-and-so. So there was a, you know, a writing credit versus a story credit.
Right.
In this book, in every single issue, and let me tell you, I've been to the Comixology website, I've been to the Comic Book DB website, I've been to DC's official website, in every single frickin' place, with every single issue, they list all 4 writers. So when I'm like, geez, this issue was kind of weak, or I thought this one was a lot better, who was writing it? I have no idea. So that's just kind of minutely infuriating, and okay, maybe in some crazy weird world they actually all actively collaborated on each issue, but I refuse to believe that 99%.
Gotcha.
I am almost certain that did not happen. You know, Batman Eternal was written in arcs, you know.
Yeah.
So I have to believe this was done the same way. Beyond that, I read Archer and Armstrong #1, or technically, because it's been rebooted, we can call it A&A #1, or an ampersand sandwiched by a pair of A's #1, whichever one
Whatever,
you want.
Yeah.
Surprisingly, it's actually not a great jumping on point. And obviously I'm okay with that. But I was really, really shocked that for Valiant being like, and it's not just Valiant, but it's most publishers, hey, it's the beginning of a new arc. That means you ought to try this book. Okay. That's not always true. But this is really not that approachable. It sort of assumes that you know a lot of the characters and their back history, and I'm okay with that. It's just, it's different.
I think that it's... I mean, I actually don't mind that either. And I sometimes get frustrated when every new story arc needs to be a great jumping on point for new readers. Like, yeah. If I'm a new reader, I don't have any investment in starting right now. Like, what? There's no problem with me going back to the beginning. But for people who are keeping up, it's like, why do we have to reset everything every five issues? So I don't know. I like that.
Yeah, it's basically a lose-lose because either A, you are genuinely attempting to try to make it a jumping on point, which after, you know, getting this three or four arcs in a row, that's super annoying to ongoing readers, or B, you're just flat out lying about the fact that it's a jumping on point, and that's, you know, that's annoying too. Beyond that, I would say Nick's other crazy stupid fun read of the week was another arc of Predator called Cold War, which, as you guessed it, was written before the Soviet Union dissolved. Nothing quite brings the U.S. and the USSR together to have a shared enemy like a Predator. So, all is forgiven. Let's just join hands and hope that those three laser points don't, show up on our chests. So... really dumb, but also really hilarious.
I can't imagine what this story could even be about. That's insane.
Oh, it's like a remote, like, Arctic outpost, and, like, the guy who fights the Predator in the first story, who's the brother of Arnold Schwarzenegger from the movie, meets up with this, of course, she's, an attractive Soviet commander, and they're gonna, we hate each other, but eventually we all know how this is gonna play out.
Oh,
we're gonna
God.
Melt this Arctic tundra with our romance. I hope that line shows up.
I can only hope that that's actually the dialogue.
Yeah, and then, like, the Predator, like, spies in on them, mid, whatever, with the heat vision. I think I've already written the end of this comic.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about you, Mike?
Oh, I actually read a lot this week, but I picked just a couple books to talk about. I've been purposefully trying to catch up on all my backlog of issues, as well as read the plethora of new issues that I've just been sitting on, and I don't know why. So I read all of my floppy books, and I read, like, an Injection number 7. I read The Spire. I read Ninth Wave. But the ones that I kind of want to look at was, I read Mighty Morphin Power Rangers number 1 from Boom, and I bought it because I actually bought the copy of the issue for my brother, because my brother, my younger brother, he's 2 years younger than me, really, really loved the Power Rangers when we were growing up, and he still to this day, like, will put on Netflix and watch some old Power Rangers episodes, because some of them are actually on there, and, well, yeah, I should say,
that's kinda
I should
weird.
Also
he
add
seems
to that.
Too young for them, almost.
He was almost too young for them, and that's, I mean, because I watched it, so he watched it with me, and then as he grew up, I got away from it, but he continued to watch when they changed over teams and changed over teams and changed over teams. So I bought a copy of number 1 because it takes place back in the first series in the 90s with Jason and Trini and Billy and Tommy and Kimberly and Zach, and it's fantastic. Like, and so the book was like bringing me back to being very, very young, and I kind of enjoyed that. But it's very, very more, very much more introspective, so you get a little bit more inside of these characters' heads, which in my head, like, when I was watching the show, I never thought about that anybody had, like, any feelings. They were just like, we have this thing to do, and we're going to fight the bad guy. But then there's, like, these characters actually have emotions.
Screw your feelings.
So it was, well, I mean, like, there was always the thing between Billy and Kimberly, but Kimberly, like, Tommy and whatever. But... Anyways,
teenagers with too much attitude now.
Exactly. And they all know karate, and Bulk and Skull are just jerks and terrible. So the comic is all about Bulk and Skull initially trying to, like, interview people about the Power Rangers, and Tommy fighting with this, struggling with this, I was once a bad guy, now I'm a good guy. So for anyone who actually watched the show, this takes place pretty much in the middle of season one, maybe end of season one, when Tommy was a bad guy and then he became a good guy, and now they're trying to fight Rita, but Rita's still in Tommy's head. So context aside,
I follow
aside,
you. Don't worry.
It was a fun read.
Right with you on that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I kind of enjoyed it. I don't know if I'll continue to pick it up. Maybe I'll grab it in trade, or if it goes on sale and I can get a bunch of issues for really cheap. But it was fun, and I think that people who really enjoyed that, like when they were younger, will definitely get a kick out of it. Otherwise, I read All New X-Men number 6. I read that earlier this week, and this comic book is the most bland X-Men book I've ever read.
Oh, not no.
I ask every week,
Mike, which one is this again?
So this is All New X-Men, which features the...
Is this the Hopeless or the Lemire book?
This is the Dennis Hopeless book.
Okay.
And with art by Mark Bagley, and it's actually kind of cool in that, like when you, I don't know if you guys read Ultimate Spider-Man or not, but like it feels just like a comic book. Like it's classic looking comic book art. There's nothing that's like breaking the mold by any means. And that's okay, I think. I think sometimes we need comics that are like that. And that's not to say that Mark Bagley's art's bad by any means, because it's not. It's actually very great. But the story is just riddled with like cliche drama and it feels like they didn't know what to do with all the young X-Men teams, so the team that came back from the 60s and now exists in modern day. And so they kind of just threw a couple other like weirdo characters that they didn't know what to do with into this story. And now they're making them fight classic X-Men villains. But now those classic X-Men villains have had years to prepare. They already know how to like beat the X-Men, but there's something bigger going on.
What?
It's way out there. There's this relationship between X-23 and Angel that's really weird. And it's very much just on the nose about all sorts of different subjects, and it kind of just rubs me the wrong way. There's no nuance. There's no like real thought to it. It's kind of just like, here's a boilerplate X-Men story and just write it. And it's so weird because I think Dennis Hopeless is actually a pretty good writer. I really enjoyed his work on Cable and X-Force, which is why I was immediately drawn to this book. But this series is just... blah. I don't know. It's kind of just boring. In comparison, at least, to Extraordinary X-Men and All-New Wolverine. I don't know. So I'm going to keep reading because I have hope. I've fought Surprise. Through many, many issues like this before. So hopefully it will get better. And I think the most recent issue had a little bit of a twist at the end. But I'm just sick of Cyclops whining.
Oh, and, God. Take a number.
I know. And again, this is why it feels like just another standard X-Men story, because it's Colossus whining and the rest of the team kind of unsure of themselves because their leader doesn't know his place, so they don't know their place, and it's bizarre.
But I want an X-Men book where they do something to make me care about fucking Cyclops.
You should read the Cyclops series that came out. That's a pretty good one.
But like, what do they do with him that makes him not not Ross Geller?
Did they ever have an issue where he just goes insane and just starts vaporizing everything?
No.
Like, he just forgets his visor one day, and it's just him walking around town just eviscerating everything.
No, well, okay, that's actually what happened during AVX. He kind of became a bad guy.
Oh, my God. Of course
I mean, he was a bad
happened.
Guy, good guy, whatever. But actually, what was great about the Cyclops series was that it's all about him, like, finding or reestablishing his relationship with his dad. And... in Cyclops' history, like, basically what happened is Cyclops' dad, he went off into space and became a star jammer. And, like, we've run into, like, Cyclops' dad over the many, many years of X-Men, but it's always like, oh, you're my estranged father. We have to fight these bad guys. Okay, Dad, you're going back off to space. I'm staying here on Earth. And so Cyclops actually, he meets his dad, and he's like, dude, you left when I was a child. I need to come with you. I'm young now. We can actually make this work. We can establish a good relationship. And so he goes off to space with his dad for 16, 20 issues. And it's really good. Like, it's there's a lot of father-son bonding. There's a lot of just, I don't know, hijinks. And, like, it's kind of goofy, but it's also, like, action-packed at the same time. So it's a really good story about Cyclops. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Greg Rucka did a lot of that. So...
that sounds promising.
It's a very good book.
Sorry, all I got from that really was that Cyclops' dad, even at a very young age, figured out that he didn't want to spend any time with his son.
Oh, that's...
I mean...
can you imagine the note he left for Cyclops?
Oh, God.
They go into it in the story. It's very heartbreaking. And
see you later, Four Eyes.
They fix it.
Oh, no.
God.
We're terrible people. I'm sorry.
I know.
So the other book that I read this week was Jonesy Number 2, and this is the most goofy, out there, bizarro book written by Sam Humphries with art by, I can't think of her name off the top of my head. It's a really goofy book. I don't know how else to explain it, because it feels like what I imagine Adventure Time being, but with SpongeBob, and also it looks like Brian Lee O'Malley's art, but the dialogue is written like, I don't know, like a teenage girl, because the character's a teenage girl. So it's really goofy, and it's a lot of fun. And I every time I read it, I'm just constantly face-palming because of how just, like, dumb funny it is in some ways. So it's going to be a fun little four-issue miniseries. And finally, the last thing I want to talk about is Rat Queens number 15, which I finally sat down and read. And I really am not a fan of where this book has gone. Like, the last two or three issues were kind of pushing the limit. I was ready for the team to get back to doing, like, adventuring things, which is what drew me into the book. And instead, they've just damaged all of the characters, and they aren't trying to make amends for that. Like, they've taken the necromancer character, whose name escapes me because I'm on the spot and I can't think of it, and they've just gone absolutely wild with her backstory and made everything just insane. And the book just it's not fun anymore. It's way, way dramatic. And that's, I don't know. I wanted, Rat Queens was a lot of fun with drama, but it had fun in it. And now it's no longer fun and everything's sad. And I don't know if I like it anymore. It's kind of bothering me. I'm going to give it another like issue or two, but this most recent issue totally just went off the rails. So
this is what I'm hearing from everyone who reads that book.
Yeah.
It's such a bummer. That seems
to be a very uniform opinion. And you have to wonder if any of that had to do with the delays and the art swapping and the whole Rock Up Church controversy or if this was just inevitable.
I don't know if this was the intended story long term. But it doesn't feel like the same book. Like, it felt like the same book up until, like, the last three issues. And now it's had, like, taken a dramatic turn for the worse, in my opinion. So,
is there something out there that you would suggest for people who like kind of traditional fantasy with a more mature / comedic
I feel vibe like you're, this is a leading question because I'm going to say Skull Kickers, but...
Yeah. Okay. I was just curious if you had anything else beyond that in mind, because that's the only thing that naturally comes to mind for me.
There's a Pathfinder book that Jim Zub has been writing or wrote for a little while. And
very same author.
Yeah. And then there was a D&D comic that came out, like the Forgotten Realms, and those are all really good if you're into like super hardcore fantasy. So, we've talked a lot about what we read this past week, so let's talk about what we're excited about this week, and we can maybe try to trim it down just a little bit. So, Tia, what are you excited for this week? I know it's a slow week, it's kind of a small week for all of us, but what are you excited for?
Yeah, this is really a slow week coming up for me. There wasn't too much that I was excited about, so I just am going to throw a pick out there based purely on the coolness of the cover. Awesome. I mean, I read Darth Vader. I'm recommending Darth Vader number 18, and I read it. Am I all the way caught up? I don't even know. But this cover looks like Darth Vader's pop album, which is awesome. He's got like stormtrooper backup dancers and like lights shooting out, and it just, yeah, looks awesome. Can't go wrong with Darth Vader.
What? Okay.
Wow.
I haven't seen this cover, but I will definitely have to check it out. Nick, what are you excited for this week?
For me, it's actually, this week is so light that it was either down to They're Not Like Us, which I'm not caught up on, or me actually pulling a book off of my, Nick, you read this every month, but it's not on your pull because that makes it seem like your pull is under control list, which is a longer list than it should be. And that would be Omega Men, number 10. We're finally getting to the end of this series, and 9 was really, really interesting because Kyle Rayner learned that sometimes when you try to please everyone, it just does not work, and everyone turns on you. And that's sort of how the issue ends, and it was really, really interesting what they decided to do with the last page, because anyone who's been reading Omega Men knows that the last page tends to be a 3x3 total of, you know, 9 panel layout that they usually also begin the book with. And they did that, but they also did it in a very unconventional way that sort of conjoined the previous layout that they've been using alongside sort of the big old traditional sort of big splash page cliffhanger ending that you see in a lot of more traditional comic books. And they kind of smashed the two together to make this really kind of bizarre yet crazy yet exciting moment for the series. And I don't want to reveal it, but it could be really interesting to see what they do with these last three issues, because what they did at the end of 9 could either really make or break this book.
Gotcha. Wowzer. I read number 1, so maybe I will.
So you're basically there. I mean, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Cannot say enough good things about this book. If you haven't started reading it yet, Tom King most recently said that he has plans. We'll see if DC agrees. To put this out as a big 12-issue trade. And cool. The fact that we're nearly on 10 and we haven't seen like a part one trade, I'm inclined to believe that that's how it will be released anyway. So
it's exciting. Well, for me, I'm excited. This week, like I said, it's very small, or it's smaller than usual, or at least the books on my poll, none of them really grabbed me as far as being excited. I had All New X-Men. All. Yeah, well, All New X Men number 7 is on there.
Introspection.
Yeah, but All New X Men number 7 was on my list, and you just heard me talk about All New X Men number 6. So I don't know, but the one that I guess I'm probably most excited for, because it's the end of the series, is Fight Club 2 number 10, and this is a very weird book. Like I was thinking about number 9 as I was, you know, coming up with trying to figure out what was going to be my pick this week, and I'm really worried that this book is going to end in the worst way possible. Not that there's a build up to potentially like make it bad, but that Chuck Palahniuk doesn't actually have an ending. Because basically where the issue 9 left us off is this major cliffhanger, and there are so many unresolved plot points that could potentially take the lead for this final issue. They've all been like surfacing and unsurfacing, I guess, throughout the whole series, that like I don't know who, like which one is going to take precedent, and I'm really worried that they're going to just meta their way out of the story in the worst way possible, as they've been doing for the past two or three issues, where literally the main character Sebastian, they actually gave the narrator a name in this series, Sebastian, he calls Chuck Palahniuk. He like actually calls Chuck Palahniuk as they're doing rewrites for the scripts of the current story. So it's very, very aware that it is a comic book, but they're not like talking to the reader. They're just talking from the writer to the creation in a weird, like stranger than fiction kind of way. And the constant question is, where's the conclusion? What's the conclusion from the character to Chuck Palahniuk, to his co-writers or people that he's working with on the book. So I'm really worried that they're just not going to end it and instead say, like, Chuck Palahniuk's just going to give us 22 pages of actual prose that says, I didn't really have an ending for this. I just wanted to see what we could do. So I don't know. I'm really worried.
And then people will go, what a genius ending.
No. I think he lost that title of genius somewhere along when Pygmy was published, or any of the books that came out after Lullaby, as far as I'm concerned, but maybe that's just me.
Oh, well, you know, Mike just set the record straight on that, you know?
Yeah. I don't know if either of you have read any Chuck Palahniuk books, but...
I try not to.
Okay. I read a handful, and I mean, yeah, they're not all winners. So... On that sad note, let's take a break.
We are just all delightful today.
This week, I'm sorry, this is going to be a bad episode. This is going to be a terrible subject. We're all going to be mad at each other at the end. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about what we are calling edgy comics, or what makes a comic book edgy, what constitutes an edgy comic. So it should just be a whole ball of laughs. So we'll be back in just a second. As I said just a moment ago, this week's topic is going to be focusing on what we're calling quote-unquote edgy comics. And that's a very, very broad definition as far as what that actually means, because it's to me, it's sort of subjective, and to others, it's not. And what edgy actually encompasses is a far range of different things, but we think we've broken this topic into two different sides. One side being like form and structure, and the other side being content. So I don't know necessarily where to begin, but really the thing, the reason why I brought this topic to the table, or maybe I didn't, I think maybe someone else did, but someone wanted to talk about edgy comics, and in my head it was you. Okay, it was Tia. This is all Tia's fault, so I'm sorry. This is a bad episode. It's all Tia's fault. No.
Whoa, just right under the bus. Yeah. Jeez.
What we're trying to get at is that edgy comics are like a thing that, you know, when you're reading a review or you're reading a piece or an article about a comic, someone will say, oh, it was really edgy. And that's a really broad term in a lot of ways, because edginess can be, is multifaceted. As I said, you know, we've split the idea into what we think are two pretty good solid sides, or two different prongs on this. But edginess is a very weird thing, and a lot of the time people will use the word edgy to describe the content of a book. So I think we should probably start by talking about that. You know, what is edgy content? What does it mean for a book to have edgy content? And before we started the show, you know, we sat down and talked a little bit about what this actually means to us, and we all came up with a ton of different answers and a ton of different examples. So Nick and Tia, I mean, I'll send this over to you guys. What do you constitute, you know, edgy in comic books? As far as content goes, at least.
Well, for me, I really see it as something that pushes boundaries in a culturally productive way. That culturally productive part is really the key for me. I think that, so obviously, in the sense of context, that part of it is subjective. But the abstract idea of pushing boundaries in a way that is useful, I think is actually a pretty fixed idea.
Gotcha. And so would you say that there's like a good way to be edgy and a bad way to be edgy? I know that's really, I don't know. I don't want to say there is a good and bad way, but I mean, I think there are examples that we could point out and say, you know, this thing actually, you know, it was edgy, it was out there, and the story was strange, and that actually led to, you know, inspire others to do more compelling work. Whereas, you know, in other cases, it's simply, you know, to be gratuitous and, you know, do something that's just off the wall and crazy simply to, I guess, offend people in a certain way, right?
Yeah, and I think that rather than being edgy, that sort of gratuitous shock value is quite juvenile and regressive in my mind. So I think that when you look at, so I was just reading Punisher Max, for example.
Right, this is the Garth Ennis book?
The Garth Ennis book. And I really want to like Punisher. In fact, I think that if you look at the types of things I tend to gravitate towards in a character, Punisher should be my favorite character. I love anti-heroes. I love assholes. I just, you know, I don't have a lot of patience for the, like, squeaky clean do-gooder type characters. And that's Frank Castle, you know? And so I tend to not read books that have a lot of ultra violence, particularly towards women, because I find it very offensive and unnecessary. Mm-hmm. But I knew that I was going to have an open mind about that going into this book. And I tried really hard to start out by giving these scenes the benefit of the doubt that they're, and really think through, like, what are they doing for this character or this story? And most of the time, they weren't doing anything. They were just there. And if you gave them even the smallest bit of analysis within the framework of the character or the story, they actually didn't make any sense. There was no reason for them to be there. They were, like, actively muddying the story. And so I think that sometimes rather than being edgy, this ultra-violence becomes very conventional, which people, I think, don't think about it, because ultra-violence is very shocking in that we have a visceral reaction to it. But in terms of what it does for the medium, I think it's very regressive.
Right. And I mean, you pointed out Garth Ennis simply because I think that he is typically one of those creators that pushes that line a lot. Specifically, you know, that run of Punisher is very violent. The series Cross that he started is pretty much the epitome of, I think, what we're talking about here. Pushing the boundaries just to find the boundaries. And in some ways, you know, you have to experiment and you have to try things. But I think to the extent of something like Crossed, or from what you've described to me, you know, from the Punisher run, I think maybe it is, like you said, it's juvenile, it's regressive. It's not actually contributing to the greater comics medium. It's essentially just testing the waters to see how far you can actually go before someone goes, okay, that's too much.
And I do think that historically, you know, if you want to bring in like the comics code that really drew a lot of very constraining lines in terms of what you could put in a comic book and what would sell in a comic book, I understand kind of why at a certain point historically that kind of content would be very edgy, but it's been a while since we've done away with the comics code. And like, it, you know, thumbing your nose at the like authoritative rules is not enough anymore.
I don't think we're trying to necessarily say that just for my own sanity, I mean, just like that we're trying to say you should censor these types of comics, but like there should be some choice in when you're using these acts to actually do something in the story, right? It shouldn't just be for the sake of, okay, let's have a guy with a horse penis kill someone with that thing, you know? I'm citing Crossed here. That actually happened. There was a guy whose name is...
Where is this coming from?
I'm not like, just pulling this out of my
you
ass.
You went
There's
to that
character.
Example so fast.
Yeah, yeah. His name is Horsecock, and he kills people with a giant horse penis. This is Crossed.
Well, use what you've got, right?
I guess. And it's...
Smoke them if you got them.
And maybe it's, you know, sometimes you have to wonder, you know, like, is it because of that reaction? Like, they want to see how, you know, these creators that write these types of stories, are they trying to see how far they can push it because it's so dark that it becomes funny?
Right.
And is it funny because we're uncomfortable with it, or is it funny because of just how insane and gratuitous they are? And I'm specifically talking about, you know, just gory, gory, nasty violence. And I think, Tia, to your point, you're talking about was a rape scene in Punisher that didn't actually help drive the story. It was just kind of there, right?
So, yeah. So what I think they're trying to do... So basically, they're in Vietnam and they catch the sniper and the other guys in the platoon start to rape her. And so Frank shoots her in the face. And in his mind, he's helping.
Oh, God, it's a mercy kill. Oh,
yeah.
Jesus.
And,
oh, boy.
And I'm like, okay, you know what? I get what you're trying to do. You're trying to show us how fucked up Frank Castle's idea of right and wrong and, like, how screwed up his sense of helping people is. I get that.
Yeah.
But the way, and I think that you could have even still had the rape and had the, you know, the mercy killing. Like, you could have kept that in there, but the way that it was presented felt very, I don't know.
Lazy.
Lazy and also aestheticized, which is weird because in the back of the book, I read the collected volume of Punisher Max, and in the back there's some writer and artist notes, and the artist calls out this page and he's like, oh yeah, so you see it happen from the back, so you see like a soldier on top of her with his pants down and Frank like shooting her, but you don't see her face, and the artist is like, I wanted to like give her some dignity, so I thought it would be like too disrespectful to show her being shot in the face. And it's like, you could show her being raped, but not being shot in the face. What, that seems like a very arbitrary line to me,
yeah,
which makes me believe that you did not really actually think through what the scene was doing.
Yeah.
I mean, what it sounds like to me is, and God, I hate this line. It's so cliche, but really a lot of this is just because you can doesn't mean you should. And I think when you deal with the Max imprint, or when you deal with things like that. There's almost like sort of a built-in checklist of like, these are the things we're allowed to do because we're not a normal Marvel book now, or with Vertigo, you know, these are the things we can get away with because we're not a conventional DC book. So, you know, if I don't include boobs, you know, I'm missing out, because I mean, how am I going to get a bingo and gratuitous whatever if I don't? So I don't know. Obviously, like you were saying, sometimes this can be detrimental, this idea that people feel like this stuff has to be there to begin with.
Yeah. And to go back to what I was saying is, I think there's a difference here in the types of violence that we're portraying against, you know, against people. And it's like,
right,
murder versus, you know, violence. At
hyper
the end of
violence
the day.
Can lend itself to a narrative.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And
to the humor. Like I was saying, like if you look at RoboCop or Evil Dead or something like that, I mean, those movies are chock full of hyper violence, but they're also trying to say something and set the tone for their piece within it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, well, we can do this, so here's some hyper violence
right.
for you, because this is a Max book after all.
Well, yeah, and I think, yeah, to that point, you could even say, you know, something like Judge Dredd, or even...
Yeah,
even,
oh, you know, absolutely.
The book that I always go to, because Avatar is kind of the publisher that we're getting at, but we're not trying to grab that directly.
What about Bedlam, want a non-crossed example?
And I was going to say, well, not cross necessarily, but I was going to cite something like Uber being a book about these super-powered individuals in World War II, and it's supposed to be a representation of, you know, the atom bomb, but in human form. And the violence there is necessary because it's showing the... what people with massive amounts of power can do to the everyday human. And it's disgusting, yeah. And it's awful, but like these are the stories of war, and it's there to show that war is absolutely awful, and look at what it does to not only individual people but entire cultures in a go. I think that violence is necessary to tell the story, and I don't think any moment of violence was thrown in there simply to say, well, let's do this where it looks like this guy's head is exploding but his foot's coming out of his mouth because of this bomb. It's like these people are dying, and there's at least some level of respect there, I think.
Well, I mean, I feel like Kieran Gillen is one of the writers I will trust with that kind of violence. Because Mercury Heat is the same way. Like, it's pretty violent. It's really violent. But I never get the sense that I'm supposed to be enjoying the violence.
Yeah.
You know, as a reader, like, also, I think I talked about the last issue that had the crossed crossover, but like kind of poked fun at it like censored it with like happy bunny stickers.
Yeah, so, you mentioned that.
Yeah.
On another episode, I should say.
It was the last episode I think I was on. I think you just a little self-awareness about how horrific the violence is in some of these books goes a long way towards, I think, making the reader more, comfortable isn't the right word, but trusting in the creator to respect the visceral reaction that I am likely to have to the violence. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, like you're being pushed into this emotion for a reason, not simply to shock you, not to like, I guess. And on that note, I could even carry this over to one of the other examples I had cited in our notes. Looking at something like Mark Miller's The Unfunnies or his Nemesis series, and Nemesis in specific,
oh God, Nemesis.
Was a book that I was really excited for on concept, where it was something like, what if someone with the power of Tony Stark could, you know, was a supervillain, you know? And I mean, we've seen this kind of story told over and over, but this was taken to another level, where the idea was that this guy, this supervillain guy, he would find the top cop in all these different countries around the world and try to challenge them to try to find him and catch him by doing these horrific things to him and his family and to people he knows, people in his city. And in that book, there were so many just shock-inducing moments simply just for the sake of them. Like this whole story could have been done in a much simpler way, but instead Miller decides to push the line at every single chance he has. And it's near the end of the book, I was kind of just sick of it. I was kind of done with the book, and I really didn't want any more of it. And I was glad that it was over, because I was mostly just sickened by the story. And I wanted to see it through to the end. And of course, the biggest, nastiest twist happens right near the end of the book. So I didn't really see it coming. And I was kind of just taken aback, because it was so
fucking awful.
If you
saw that coming, like, yeah. What's wrong with you?
I don't want to spoil it. I wouldn't suggest reading this book, but it is that is one of the more gross comic books I've read in a very long time. And I'm also read a lot of Crossed too. So like, if that's your bar, I don't know. It's out there. It's very, very out there and disgusting.
It's really weird, because I think Mark Waid's, what is it, Irredeemable, is almost like that story told right.
Absolutely. About Superman who's gone crazy and starts killing everyone.
Oh yeah, I've seen that one. Yeah, I would agree with that.
It's funny that actually played out that way, but Irredeemable, it's almost like Mark Millar's editor, like he tricked him and like locked him into a room and sent it off to the printers without anyone getting a chance to actually take a look at it.
Yeah, Nemesis, you mean? Yeah, Nemesis, sorry.
Yeah, Nemesis. But it's almost weird, because I think sometimes the books that have this violence, which is really out of place, over the top, ill-suited, doesn't further the narrative, I think those are the things we almost always call edgy, more than the books where the violence or whatever is so well integrated into the narrative that we don't stop to think about it as being edgy, or being like, wow, like this is like really crazy, insane, like what's going on here?
Because of that, we're not looking at the violence as part of the edginess. We're looking for the story. We're looking for the actual narrative to tell us something and do something interesting. But, you know, as with the violence as a commentary,
it's more than just
society.
A shock jockey effect.
Yeah, yeah.
I've noticed, and, you know, I have two things that will almost automatically make me not read a book. And one is rape, and one is violence against animals. I have to have a lot of trust in creators to see through a book that has either of those things. And it just gets exhausting that often when we're talking about ultraviolence or for mature readers or edginess, it almost always is taking place on women's bodies. And it just gets so exhausting as a woman comic book reader to be like, look, I want to read adult content. I want to read about mature themes, and I don't mind violence, and I want to read, I don't have any problem with sex in books, but like, why is it always happening literally on women's bodies?
Yeah, that's
I don't have an answer.
Sorry.
Unfortunately.
That's my rant.
No, it's
we have just been made personally accountable for answering that question. No, I'm just kidding.
No.
I just love the silence that followed. It's like, Mike?
Totally a valid question. I mean, it's and I think more and more creators are aware of that. I guess I shouldn't say more and more. If more means 1 out of 100, I guess that's technically more. But
I'm going to start a dong counter where I'm going to award points to every book that has like equal amount of penis as it does female nudity.
I would say nowadays.
No,
you'd be surprised.
Yeah. It's happening. I love it. I try to call those books out when I find them and give them a high five.
Equal opportunity nudity, I guess is what it is. And that's, I don't know. That's, I wish that I had an answer for that question. I think that there's probably, if I had to take a guess at this, it's because of this inherent cultural thing that we say, you know, women are these protected, sacred things that should not be violated. So when that violation does happen in a story, like it gets the blood up, you know, like people are should be, I think the idea is that they should be more upset by it, but instead it's objectifying. I mean, and that's the ultimate, you know, like to me seems obvious probably because I'm so in this idea, but like it's objectifying to try to like to make men upset, but it doesn't make men upset a lot of the times. I think continued story point.
Well,
I am shocked
go ahead.
I am literally shocked that this is the way that you're thinking about it, because I look at it and I just think like, oh yeah, I guess dudes like seeing women get raped a lot, because what else am I supposed to think about that?
No, I I think that I don't think that that's what it is. I think that a lot of the times the intention is to say it's this gender role thing, which is it's a whole nother discussion, right? But it's that the men should be protecting women, and when women, you know, are you know, on their own or are taken advantage of, the men are supposed to go and save them and redeem them somehow. And that's just be that was, you know, has been the cultural norm for however many years, and is in some circles, I think, still. I think we're seeing a bit of a change in that in comic books, at least a little bit. But like that's, I think that was the initial implication, is that like, oh shit, this thing that you're supposed to be taking care of is now being taken advantage of because of your neglect, and therefore the men feel like they have to redeem themselves and fix the problem. And that's because these comic books are geared towards men. They're not written for everyone. They're written for men, and women happen to read them. And that's the unfortunate side of it, I think.
I think that's, yeah, probably very true and unfortunate.
Yeah. So, sorry. I didn't mean to get on a big soapbox there, but that's the shit of it.
I talk about this a lot with my female comic nerd friends, and I don't often really hear what dudes think about it, and it's kind of interesting. I really don't know what dudes think of it.
Well, doesn't a lot of that unfortunately also basically boil down to the idea that the hero of all of these stories, the hero is always male, and so you can't kill him, you can't really endanger him, so it really boils down to the lazy notion that you either need to endanger his wife, his girlfriend, his mother, or his daughter. His
children in general, usually, because, but yeah. It's all this perpetuating idea of, you know, the man is the strongest and everything else is not. Like, no matter who these other people may be, they are not as strong as the protagonist. And that's the rub of it, I guess.
And what I'm getting from all of this discussion is that this is not edgy. This is not avant-garde. It's not pushing boundaries. It's extraordinarily conventional, to the point that
it's lazy.
Yeah, it is a very well-tread trope. So does that mean that stuff like Patsy Walker or Squirrel Girl or Ms. Marvel, does that mean that that's what edgy now, because it's pushing, it's boundary pushing, because it isn't dark and grim and gross?
I mean, in a weird way, I always found Jeff Lemire's run of Animal Man to be edgy, because the guy actually had a family that, for the most part, didn't end up dead by the end of the run.
Yeah.
You know, he actually had a wife who was, like, supportive and but also had, you know, they had conflict and issues like any couple, and she didn't end up dead at the end. I don't want to reveal what did end up happening, but it was also kind of groundbreaking and unconventional, and yet also very dark and moody. And if you haven't read Jeff Lemire's Animal Man run, I cannot encourage that book enough. It is, like, if you want to talk about doing stuff that's dark but unconventional but not gratuitous, this book somehow just treads that line so perfectly.
Yeah, I totally agree. Tia, to your point with Ms. Marvel and Squirrel Girl and things like that, what's really interesting about those stories is that all the problems that are happening aren't trying to take the loved ones of those characters and put them in danger. Instead, the troubles are actually on the character, and they have to solve the problem. And I think that's really interesting, because it's not using that, like, that lazy trope of, oh, your loved ones are in danger, therefore it's your problem. Like, which is something that I think is really funny about the Ms. Marvel series that was run, that came out during Civil War. It was written by Brian Reed. I really do like a lot of aspects of that book, but one of the problems was that at one point her boyfriend gets kidnapped and she has to go save him, and you go, oh, look, they switched the trope, but it's the same exact story. It's lazy. And the problem should be on the character. And I think that this is a common trope that we've probably seen in the last, like, 30 years, where we can't kill the protag. Instead, we have to attack their loved ones. So we've got our Robins, we've got our Batgirls, we've got our, you know, Commissioner Gordon's daughter, you know, we've got a plethora of other stories with this exact same story.
Hey, I just want to point out, before you go after Batman too much, that look, okay, the guy starts with no parents, okay, so they can't go after them. He's not that interested in dating women for the most part, so you really don't have them. You just have these, like, 12 to 13-year-old boys that he just doesn't look out for that much that end up dead. I mean,
can you please, like, get on writing the Batman is asexual book? That would be interesting. That would be
Batman
edgy.
Is like Jughead in that he doesn't love any person. He loves justice. And in Jughead's case, he loves hamburgers.
He loves putting bat in front of every
noun. Yeah. But yeah, exactly. Like Jughead being asexual, Batman being like that's edgy. That is.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, everyone's like, oh, what if Batman's gay? No, what if Batman's just not interested in anything? Like,
I think that's the more groundbreaking storyline right there. He just loves justice that much. But and I think this is us kind of switching over to the other side of this discussion, right? Where we're not talking about necessarily the content, but we're talking about the story structure and we're talking about the contents and the way that the story is told using different tropes or trying to reimagine tropes in such a different way that they are no longer the same trope anymore, which I guess defeats the purpose of it being a trope in the first place. But
well, I would say that I would also bring in, I think that Odyssey, the Matt Fraction Christian Ward book right now, is a great segue into this part of it. You know, where they're taking one of the most classic stories in Western canon, and they're reimagining it as a sort of gender-bent sci-fi story. Christian Ward, you know, I posted on Tumblr a couple of weeks ago, like, I'm legit worried for the man that, like, you know, the gods get really jealous when mortals are, like, super talented or, like, some fairies are going to come steal him. Like, that man is just ridiculous talented. And the stuff that he's doing with color and design is so boundary pushing and so edgy. And I think that it's definitely worth talking about that sort of structural edginess in addition to swapping genders or changing up these tropes.
I actually haven't read. I only read the first issue of that book. I haven't read any more.
The very least, follow him on Twitter because he just got a puppy and it's really cute.
Oh, okay. Not only Mike, is he a talented artist.
I don't even know
artist.
What his artwork looks like, yeah. But he has a dog.
Yeah, exactly.
Its name is Thor. Yeah.
Oh, geez.
But to that point of story structure, I think one key example that I can think of in recently is something like Alice Cott's The Surface. And Xander and I, we talked about this in a mini-sode that will eventually come out, I think, someday. But that book took an idea of this we live in a hologram matrix style story, and the story ended up not being about that anymore. I mean, it was a huge metaphor for something else, and I don't want to necessarily spoil it because it's a 4-issue miniseries and everybody should go read it because I think it just will kind of, it'll make you think and tap your head and wonder, like, what was this story actually about? But the way that that story went from one path to another so gradually and then suddenly, like, near the end, very abruptly, to allow Alice Cott to do some introspection and talk about his life and actually figure out what he was doing and what he was thinking and feeling in life through a story that got published that anyone can read, where you can see the struggles of one human being, like, that to me is super edgy. I guess that's like, that was a huge trust that Image put in him to say, okay, we'll let you tell this story. And I don't know, that it's things like that that kind of push the boundary for storytelling. And I think because of that, other writers will then create new things and say, this is how it's been done before. I can do something similar, or I can be inspired by this to create something new. Do either of you have anything like that, or have you read that book?
I love that book. Alice Cott, I think, would be very high on my list of excellent writers whom I trust implicitly to do edgy boundary pushing work. And I think that his creator owned stuff, as well as his Marvel work, is all incredibly edgy in a positive, productive way.
I absolutely agree there. Nick, have you read that series, or are you familiar with any of the Alice Cott stuff?
I think I've read the first half of The Surface, and then it all seemed, and I mean, let the judgment fall down, but it all seemed rather self-obsessed, and like I said, it was like a personal exercise that he somehow tricked Image into letting out to us, which I guess kind of brings me to my point that you can be boundary pushing, you can be experimental, you can sort of change the way we view comics and the way that we perceive sort of the spectrum of how comics can be done, but that's no guarantee that it's, and of course this is a huge fucking loaded word in its own right, but that's not a guarantee that it's going to be good or enjoyable, I guess, or a great story.
Or even well-received.
Or well-received critically or on the whole, yeah. And that's not to say that sometimes these people don't get the credit they deserve, because maybe they break the ground, but then, you know, 5 or 10 years later, somebody refines the process and, you know, distills what was experimental and interesting, but makes it much more approachable. Mm-hmm. And Paul talks about this a bunch, but if you look at, and I think this is a little reductionist, and I'm not saying that's what Paul thinks, I mean, but this is how he's brought it up briefly. I'm trying to say that I love and respect you, Paul, and I'm not about to shit on your ideas.
Yeah.
That would be a stupid thing to do. You know, he always says that Scott Snyder is the more approachable, the more distilled Grant Morrison, in a way, that the experimental ideas and concepts and whatnot that Morrison was working with, Scott Snyder sort of boiled them down to something that was much more approachable and understood by a mass audience. And so I guess that's really that sums it up pretty much. Just because you're groundbreaking doesn't mean A, you're going to get the credit, or B, that what you put out is either going to be well received, or that it's, you know, not even just that, it might be like misunderstood genius, it might actually not be quote unquote good.
I mean, I think that's true in literature and art and pretty much sure. Anything. You can't always know from the moment what of your moment is going to be the avant-garde, boundary-pushing, influential work.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, if you look at some of the stuff that is hard to read or confusing, that's probably a safe bet of where to start, you know, just because maybe time will give you a little more perspective on those things. Like, Intersect, I think, is a good example of a book that is both sort of structurally and content-wise, like, pretty edgy and pretty hard to read. I read it a lot because I really want to figure it out, because I think that it's really interesting and really beautiful. And I've actually come to the conclusion that the ineffable nature of its presentation is part of the story itself, and that it's almost like an experiential aspect where you are being thrust into this really confusing headspace, similar to what the characters themselves are actually experiencing. And,
oh, yeah.
That's what I always tell people when they don't get my stuff. I'm like, well, you're supposed to be confused. No, I'm kidding. No. I hear you, but I know what
yeah,
you mean.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I just think that, you know, what's really interesting about comics artistically is the way that time and space are presented in a two-dimensional, you know, sequential way. And so if you're going to talk about, like, what can we do that's boundary pushing in comics as a medium, I think that playing with how time and space is represented is a really sort of intuitive way to go. And so, you know, Ray Fox, I also think of Christian Ward and Marco Rudy, like, these artists are kind of just throwing gutters and panels out the window. And I think that they're doing really amazing things when they just kind of reconceive of how to present time and space in what is otherwise meant to be a sequential medium that has very sort of codified ways of presenting time and space.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, Tia. Rethinking about Intersect, I always kind of, when I read the first issue of that, and my initial thought was, it felt like the way that a lot of animators will present dreamscapes, in that it seems, when people try to, like, represent what thought and how consciousness, like, flows together with memory and things like that, that's exactly what I got out of that book.
Yeah.
I didn't continue reading it because I wasn't, like, a fan of where the story was going. I was, admittedly, I was very confused, and I was like, I don't know if I can get into this. But rethinking about it, you know, I'm kind of realizing that it felt like it was just a mishmash of thoughts and ideas, and that's the, like, a very cool way to try to approach a story, by telling things maybe out of order, by telling things through just, like, blurbs, and as a memory becomes more focused, then so does the story, and it's very interesting to me.
And that's happening to the characters, because they're, like, sort of morphing in and out of one another, or, like, of inanimate objects that they kind of, like, get somehow caught up with and sort of smushed together with. So I think that I could see that being frustrating and sort of limiting in another story, but because these characters are literally experiencing that as part of the story, it seems very clever to me to have that happen to the reader as well.
Absolutely.
As a random recommendation, if you want to talk about a whole lot of crazy, weird, experimenting sort of stuff that is all over the board, but I think also tends to make a semi-approachable narrative, I would definitely say Matt Kint's Super Spy. That book is like really, really, really weird, but it's also, I think, really well done in a way that isn't super, super experimental. And I don't want to give too much of that book away because it's, yeah.
Yeah,
I can't recommend that one enough.
I have that on my shelf.
Like, you haven't read it.
I haven't read it yet.
I was going to say, you have it, you haven't read it. Yeah, that's just a... But I think even... I think there's sort of a stereotype that I sort of want to address, which is the idea that, like, big two books are not capable of being edgy or groundbreaking. And obviously, we've sort of addressed this a bit already, but I think there's a notion that not only are they incapable of producing it, either because of a conscious or unconscious attempt to regulate, self-regulate based on the comics code, which Tia already brought up, or the idea that their bread and butter fans either aren't interested or actively are against it, because I obviously don't think that that's true at all. I think that it just happens in different ways than what we're used to. I think in a lot of ways, the edginess or the experimental stuff is happening when, against all odds, these publishers actually greenlight stories that go against what should actually make money, so to speak.
Yeah.
Like when Scott Snyder actually said, guess what? Bruce Wayne is not Batman. That alone right there is going to lose you a lot of fans, because in a lot of people's minds, Bruce Wayne equals Batman, Batman equals Bruce Wayne. There is no other way to have it. It's just not, like, it doesn't matter that Bruce Wayne will eventually get old enough, or that someone did the science and said Batman would only be able to be in peak performance for like 3 years before he wouldn't be able to be Batman anymore. Like, to those in those people's minds, like, Bruce Wayne can always be Batman. But they went ahead and Scott Snyder even went one step further than Grant Morrison, who, you know, quote unquote, killed him, because death doesn't mean anything in Big Two comics.
Yeah.
Death means you maybe have about 9 months before you show up in the big event that they're planning, basically. But I love that Scott Snyder said, guess what? What if Bruce Wayne isn't dead, but he's actually still alive? He doesn't even know he was Batman. And when he sort of starts to get the idea that he maybe was Batman, he doesn't actually want to be Batman anymore. And I don't know if either of you two remember, like, when a lot of this stuff was rolling out initially in the Bugs Bunny bat suit, or the bug suit, or I forget what they were calling it, got rolled out, and everyone was just furious.
Yeah.
Absolutely furious. Yeah. They're like, what's the suit, and who's going to be Batman, and I guess I know what book I'm not going to read anymore. Right. And so it's really interesting to see the subversion and the edginess and sort of the transformative stuff within Big Two books, because they're so heavily monitored and regulated and edited that when it happens, it's, I don't know, I find that really fascinating. Because, I mean, over at Image Comics, and this is not to totally diss Image, but, you know, the idea is, well, we can do whatever we want, however we want. And I think in a lot of ways, Image has fallen on the crutch of nudity and violence is what maturity means for a lot of the books
there. The discipline.
There. Exactly.
The handful of books we can point at about that, yeah.
Oh, sure. I mean, and to be fair, on the flip side, there are plenty of Image books that, you know, do understand that just because they can doesn't mean they should. But I always find it really interesting in Big Two books when they find ways to actually sort of subvert the norm. And just, you know, or Omega Men would be another perfect example of something that should not have worked, probably wouldn't have worked, took fan outrage to bring it back, just because no one was going to read something that weird.
And yet, that's what people want, and it's interesting to see, like, these boundaries being pushed especially at the big two, and then seeing the fan outcry for actually wanting that type of work. Like, for instance, you know, Tia, you've brought up Bucky Barnes a handful of times on the show, and I can totally say that people love Marco Rudy's art. Hand over fist, people will buy books if it has Marco Rudy's name on it, simply because they want to see how he will imagine this character or this story. And every single time, I think he hits it out of the park. I have to feel like you agree.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's one of my favorite books, probably like my top five favorite books. And I think that the story too is pretty great. You know, it's like Bucky just wants to be like happy. He just wants to settle down like everybody else. And this, you know, I agree. I think that big two books are perfectly capable of pushing boundaries. Like Fraction's Hawkeye was pretty boundary pushing, I would say. And I think it really was a game changer. Like, yeah, actually, superheroes are great, but we are also interested in them as people. And like, we don't always want to read about the winner. Sometimes, like, yeah, like, tell me about this weirdo guy who's just like literally running around with a bow and arrow with like all these superpowered people. What's his day like?
Yeah. And as far as like, you know, weirdo stories go too, I mean, we can, if we look outside of the big two, you know, we look at something like the Archie franchise on the whole, right? Yeah. We can look at what Archie's, that company's been doing for the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, maybe, with things like Afterlife with Archie, Archie versus Predator, Archie versus Sharknado, the Punisher Archie crossover that they did. Like that company is totally willing to try to push their brand out in weird ways in order to get not only sales and for people to talk
about.
They're
really whoring Archie out. But yeah, I mean, yeah. It's like,
well, Archie's always been
sorry, Archie.
Kind of a
whore. We said yes to everything. Yeah.
But I mean, that being said, like, they're willing to at least try to push boundaries to try to tell a new, interesting story and mash things up. And I don't know if that's necessarily considered edgy, but it's always interesting to see how they tell those stories, because in what, like, understandable universe would the Predator be in the Archie universe? We don't know. You know, zombies break out in the Archie universe, and then all the characters in that universe are forced to look at what is actually important to them and reflect back on the good times and figure out what they actually cherished in life. And I think that, I mean, for me, that's what drew me to the Archie franchise, was the Afterlife with Archie book, because I didn't know anything about that universe, but in the 6 issues or 7 issues that have come out, I've learned enough to say, oh my goodness, these are characters that I could care about. And I mean, that's why I'm buying Archie and Jughead, you know, that interests me. It interested me.
Well, those
me
crossovers,
enough.
I think it signals a willingness to explore outside of the box that character has existed in traditionally. So maybe these crossovers are silly, or sometimes they work and sometimes they don't, but just the fact that they're willing to try different things, I think, yeah, it speaks a lot about their willingness to at least see where things can go.
Totally.
Yeah, it's edgy because it's you know, it's active brand endangerment, so to speak.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
Which is bizarre in a way, because I think this willingness to basically throw him into anything has rejuvenated the company.
Totally.
They realize that Archie isn't just that like 500-page thing printed on super cheap paper that you find next to the Us Weekly at the supermarket anymore. Like, he's gone beyond that. And I think in a way they've sort of found a way to revive him and, you know, bring some life into him as a character, as well as just sort of joke or play around with the idea that this kid should be, you know, hanging out drinking malts and wearing a Letterman jacket or whatever, but instead he's like fighting the Predator. I don't know. Active yeah. brand endangerment.
Admittedly, it's not just Archie, but, you know, in those books, but yeah.
Yeah, and so it seems kind of hokey, but it's sort of a big deal because, you know, as I mentioned before, in this day and age, nobody really wants to do much of this anymore. Like, you know, we're not going to let our characters play with your characters. Forget that. I mean, offhand, I don't know what even comes to mind. I guess Batman 66 and Green Hornet, I guess.
Well, no, I mean, there was most recently there was the Batman Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles crossover, which is still currently going on.
Oh, yeah. And people love this stuff.
That book, I was just at Midtown. I saw a guy buying 4 copies of that book. He got every cover because, I mean, that's a big deal. That's 2 major franchises crossing over. I mean, another one I can think of is Invincible and Iron Man crossed over for a free comic book day thing. And I think those do really well. I think people really want to see how those characters would interact, even if it is really hokey and really kind of goofy to see them, you know, totally unrelated, totally impossible things happening, and yet it's enjoyable because it's not only is it new, but it's pushing the boundary of those characters in some ways. So, you know, that's it's fun stuff. Edgy. It's real edgy. Super edgy.
I almost feel like if any publisher actively markets their book as edgy, I'm like, nope, done. Like, that's it. Like, if on the back your pull quote involves the word edgy, or you reference your own material as edgy, I'm like, okay. And it's not even like a I'll be the judge of this, okay. It's a I'm probably not even going to pick this up, okay.
Well, because, you know, like we discussed earlier in the conversation, it is more than likely shorthand for a lot of ladies are getting raped in this book.
Yeah, make that the pull quote.
Oh, God.
You know, at least make it easier for me to know that I'm not interested at all.
This actually harkens back to something, Tia, you said earlier in this show, and I think Paul said in another show, and they're kind of related, in that you can't call something an instant classic based on the first issue. You can't call something instantly edgy based on the first issue. If the publisher thinks it's classic or the publisher thinks it's edgy, you got to kind of take that with like a pound of salt, because what constitutes edgy or classic to them? Like, you can't come out, like, for instance, Paul, you know, mentioned when The Dark Knight came out, you know, everyone said, oh, it's an instant classic. Oh, it's an instant classic. And that's kind of shitty. Like, how do you know
intellectually
that
dishonest?
Exactly.
Chronologically, it doesn't even make sense.
Yeah.
How are you a classic? Yeah. You have been around for 2 weeks.
Exactly. And so it's false. It's to your, like, exactly what you said, Tia. It's intellectually dishonest. I like that. That's a good phrase. So
feel free to use it in daily life.
Just say, I think as time goes by and as culture changes, people will still like this book.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not as catchy, but
I mean,
like,
yeah,
it's at least true.
You can't set out like that. Your goal in telling your story needs to have some sort of, I don't know, something with integrity, like setting out to write the, you know, next classic Batman story. Like, that in itself is not a thing that has integrity for a storyteller to do.
Yeah.
It's intellectually bankrupt.
Pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, they really should just make the pull quote on the back of books now. Maybe something instead of like instant classic, something like 5 years from now, people will still have an okay opinion of this.
Or you could just make a comment on the content of that is in the book. Like,
yeah.
I don't know, but I did. Yeah. I called it an instant
classic. This book is all right.
You know what? Everyone should just hire us from now on to come up with all of their
we'll just be straight up cynical assholes on the back of your comic. You know, you can thank us in advance.
That's right. We'll be like the new comics code, but instead of the comics code, we're like the comics conscience. We're like keeping you honest.
Yes.
What do you think constitutes an edgy comic? You can send your thoughts, essays, and diatribes to our email address, IRCB@destroythesaib.org. You can talk to us on Twitter at IRCBpodcast, and we're on Tumblr at destroythesaiborg. You can also talk with us on our subreddit at ireadcomicbooks.reddit.com. I Read Comic Books is a production of Destroy the Cyborg. Our host and producer is Mike Rappin, and the show is edited by myself, Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Moderator and Infinity Shred. You can find more of Moderator on Bandcamp at moderator.bandcamp.com, and you can find more of Infinity Shred at infinityshred.bandcamp.com. If you're looking for new podcasts, take a look at the Podern Family hashtag on Twitter. With thousands of podcasts to choose from, you can find almost any type of podcast that you're looking for. Check it out and support small podcasts like us. Finally, if you like the show, tell someone about it, or rate us online. And from all of us here at the podcast, thank you for listening.
Yeah, all you need to know about Rebirth, though, is that it's made me furious. That's it. End of story. So that's it.
That sounds like a lot of people's reactions.
The teams are bad. The art is unimpressive. The writers they brought in, I'm not crazy about. God, probably the only things I'm going to get out of this are that they reunited Peter Tomasi and Pat Gleason, a.k.a. the Batman and Robin team. They're reuniting them on Superman, which... it takes a lot for me to want to read a Superman book, so that's a thing.
I'm convinced that DC is run by a parrot that just picks ping pong balls out of a bucket with random stuff written on them.
See,
and then they just do that.
Then they'd still have a better shot than what they have right now.
Maybe it's a magic eight ball.
I think someone just gets off on unscrewing the company. I think it's like the Major League movie where you're going to find out there's someone behind the scenes actively wanting them, you know, to fail from the inside. not that it takes much work to make that happen. So
they've been infiltrated by a Marvel CEO who's secretly taking them down from the inside.
No, he's all John Romita Jr.
Work he has to do. Yeah. Oh God, don't even get me started on that. Scott Snyder is off Detective Comics. Okay, he's gonna do All-Star Batman. What? He's gonna be with John Romita Jr. Is this like my worst? This is like my worst nightmare in Mad Lib form at this point. It's like,
yeah. Some of the I just don't understand a lot of their choices.
Yeah, I like that they're actually going to try to make Detective Comics be a team Bat book to juxtapose it against Batman, because there's no denying the fact that it was always kind of weird when they were basically doing the same thing. And it's like, all right, Batman is kind of canon for everything, and Detective is like, don't think about it because it's going to hurt your brain when you try to reconcile the two coexisting.
Right.
So just don't do it. And the other guy's like, what about Justice League Batman? Just shut up.
The beatings will continue until morale improves.
Yeah. No, I don't know if there's anything else out of that I was even remotely...
I'm bummed about the Hellblazer team changing. I can't even... Like, I'm going to try it because it seems like those are some of the original Hellblazer writers. Or one of the guys is the original Hellblazer writer or something. But I think he was.
I'm just more excited because it's going to have Moritat on art, who was the original artist on All-Star Western, and he's disappeared for like 3 years. I don't know where he went, but yeah. And then David Finch on Batman. What are they thinking?
Yeah.
It's going to appeal to so many like old guard Batman fans that are like, oh yeah, Batman needs to always have like a huge grimace and like bulging muscles and like...
I totally thought you were going to name different things after both of the things that you just said.
Well, they want that too. They want that too, as long as they don't feel threatened by it.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Ugh. Semi-related, did you guys see that Batman Superman has hit $170 million at the box office this weekend, even though the Rotten Tomatoes score is at like 29%?
I assume that's just domestic?
Yeah, that's just domestic.
Okay. Interesting. I read somewhere that apparently they need $800 million to break even on this movie, which is batshit insane.
That's... wow. Wow.
I mean, like, even the more expensive Transformers movies were made for, like, $450, so wherever the fuck the money was going, I have no idea.
There are only two things about this movie that I can muster, like, even the tiniest give a damn about, and one is Wonder Woman, and the other is Henry Cavill on the press junket just, like, being the ultimate sass master and trolling people in Times Square, and, he seems kind of like a delightful asshole, which I dig that.
Maybe this is their PR campaign. You know,
In defense of the movie, I mean, I haven't seen it. I probably won't go to the theaters to see it. Mm. But everybody, all the compliments that I've seen in that movie have been like, Wonder Woman is great. Everything else sucks. And I'm like, okay, so DC, you need to get your shit in order. Like, obviously you did one thing right. And I don't understand how you managed to make a Wonder Woman movie that was called Batman versus Superman. But
and also features about 5 minutes of Wonder Woman.
Yeah, I don't know how much she's actually in the movie, but that's the one takeaway that I've heard from many, many people, that's like the shining moment in the movie is when she's in the movie and actually doing something. So at least we got that, right?
I guess we had to take something away from this. I don't know. I've made it clear how I feel about most of the people involved with this movie, so.
Yeah, it's not really important at this point. Like, I think this is the beginning of the tipping point for superhero movies. We just have to hope that Civil War isn't god-awful.
I have a lot of faith in Civil War.
Yeah. Marvel has a pretty spotless track record, all things considered, especially in the last 10 years. So I can't see them really screwing this up, but who knows? Yeah. Maybe people are burnt out on superhero movies like we've been talking about for the last, six months.
People
thought that when they released Watchmen, they thought that was going to signal. True. Just like they thought the book signaled the end, they figured the movie was going to be timed perfectly to be like, hey, we're all kind of fucking sick of these, right? And then everyone's like, this is a superhero movie. The your meaning was lost on me, and I love this superhero movie, so thank you.
Yeah.
I think that Marvel, entrusting things to the Russo brothers moving forward was a really smart move, and hopefully will give the movies a little bit more than just these are superhero movies. I felt like The Winter Soldier was a lot more than a superhero movie.
Yeah, I still can't get over that they're the guys that directed the Arrested Development pilot.
Oh God, that's right.
It's just hilarious.